You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of September 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
On Wednesday, I'll make a speech and describe what our game plans are going to be going forward. But this is not going to be an announcement about U.S. ground troops. This is not the equivalent of the Iraq War.
President Barack Obama announces that he's going to announce something about American strategy for dealing with the Islamic State. We'll consider the challenges that lie ahead and the rest of the day's headlines with Jeffrey Kaufman and Phil Clark. We'll also hear from our man in Copenhagen, and we'll talk to Francesca Gavin about the best pickings on offer from the art world, and we'll hear from the writer Lucy Mangan about her new book celebrating a half century of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, coming up right now. An action-packed 58 and a half minutes ahead of us, but before all that, Paul Osborne has the latest world news.
The World Health Organization is warning of a huge surge in the number of Ebola cases in Liberia. It says attempts to contain the spread of the disease are failing. More than 2,000 people have died from Ebola across West Africa already. A new map created by scientists studying the areas most at risk from the spread of Ebola now suggests a large part of Central Africa is at significant risk from the disease. Islamic State militants trying to seize the vital Haditha Dam in western Iraq have been repelled by Iraqi government forces. U.S. airstrikes helped to halt the advance of the Islamists. Iraq's parliament is due to vote on the proposed government of the new Prime Minister-designate Haider al-Abadi. After last week's NATO summit, the British Prime Minister David Cameron has said the international community is determined to halt the advance of Islamic State.
We must use all the instruments at our disposal, humanitarian, diplomatic and military, to squeeze this barbaric terrorist organisation out of existence. We should be clear about what needs to happen. We will continue to support the Kurds, including by providing them with arms and training their troops. We will work to support a new and representative Iraqi government, which we hope to see in place later this week.
Ukraine's president says pro-Russian rebels in the east of his country have freed 1,200 prisoners. He says an exchange of captives followed the agreement of a ceasefire late last week. That truce is still largely holding. Petro Poroshenko has been to the strategically important eastern Ukrainian port city of Mariupol, which has come under rebel fire in recent days. At least 12 people are believed to have died in a twin suicide car bomb attack in Somalia. They targeted a convoy of African Union troops travelling near the capital, Mogadishu, though most of the victims were civilians. The bombing is the first attack since the militant Islamist group Al-Shabaab vowed to avenge the killing of its leader in a US airstrike last week. A former British Prime Minister is to set out plans to devolve more powers to Scotland if the country rejects independence in a referendum next week. Gordon Brown says the proposals amount to a form of home rule. But Scotland's government says it's a last-minute panic after a poll suggested a majority of Scots now favour leaving the UK. That's led to falls in the value of the pound and companies with links to Scotland. Market analyst Jeremy Stretch says the uncertainty is likely to continue.
If there were to be a yes vote, then further uncertainty is the obvious scenario because, of course, we then have potentially months, if not years, of negotiations as we go through what is going to be an amicable or less than amicable divorce. And so the inevitable scenario is that international investors wouldn't want to be party to that.
Nigeria's government is insisting the capital of Borno State is safe from advancing Islamist militants. Government forces have seized the town of Bama, which is on the road to Maiduguri. But it's reported Boko Haram fighters have captured another key town, Machika. It's thought the group's trying to mimic Islamic State, carving out Islamist-controlled territory in the northeast of Nigeria. One of the two rival candidates to be the president of Afghanistan has again insisted he would not accept the results of a UN-backed recount of June's election. Abdullah Abdullah says the results are fraudulent. Both he and his rival Ashraf Ghani have claimed victory. President Obama spoke to both candidates over the weekend. Mr. Abdullah says he wanted the two men to work together.
President Obama was stressing on the need for making these talks coming to a successful end and successful conclusion. in the interest of formation of national unity government. And President Obama reiterated the commitment of the United States.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Paul. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We will be back right after this.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo to Buenos Aires
to Zurich to Hong Kong
to Toronto
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 18:06 here in London. That's 13:06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio, we have the journalist and broadcaster Jeffrey Kaufman and Phil Clark from London School for Oriental and African Studies. Welcome both. First of all, ancient political wisdom holds that the definition of a gaffe is a politician saying what he actually thinks and or what everyone already knew to be true. President Barack Obama perpetrated something of a modern classic of the genre last week when he acknowledged that the U.S. didn't have a strategy yet vis-a-vis dealing with the Islamic State, the Syrian-based insurrection currently making Western officials nostalgic for the relative moderation of the Taliban. Jeffrey, I'll ask you first. President Obama has said he will say something on Wednesday. The US has launched more airstrikes over the weekend to shoo the Islamic State away from the Haditha Dam. What is there that he can announce beyond the fact that we are going to perhaps just keep bombing these people till they get the idea?
He doesn't have a lot of room to maneuver, but he's got to do something. And you're right. It's essentially the strategy is likely to be what we're already seeing, which is these predator drones, no boots on the ground. That's the big term. We're not going back into the Iraq war. Don't worry about that. I think that what I'm most interested in here is, you know, he's talked and Kerry used this word, this talk of a coalition to defeat ISIS. And significant in that body, this came out of the NATO meeting, was that the only Muslim country in that coalition initially has been Turkey, which is a key player. We're now seeing the Arab League speak up, and they really have to be up at the table here if this is going to work. Because what we've learned out of Iraq, what we've learned out of Afghanistan is you can't solve the problems of any country, but in particular the Middle East, as an outsider.
Well, President Obama has said something about this, and I'll bring you in at this point, Phil. He was talking over the weekend about how the Sunni Arab states, he mentioned Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, needing to step up, as he put it. Now, even if they did, which history suggests they won't, are they actually capable of taking on the Islamic State? Isn't the problem here that America has the firepower?
Yeah, I think that is the problem. It's very unclear what military capacity those states have. And if nothing else, I think Obama's looking for some sort of diplomatic or some sort of political clout that those states can bring to bear. It's also very interesting that last week that the U.S. was a big player in an all-African anti-terrorism summit in Nairobi, which brought about 8 or 9 African presidents to talk about problems like Boko Haram and al-Shabaab. And the U.S. message actually was very similar to what we're hearing in relation to IS at the moment, which is there's this belt of Islamic terrorism right through Africa and the Middle East that could coalesce into a single front. But what we need are African partners and African proxies to actually take the fight to Boko Haram, al-Shabaab and others. So it seems that there's a very consistent message from the US, which is we're worried about this kind of terrorism, but we don't think that we can do it on our own. We're going to need Arab states, African states to actually do the bulk of the legwork on the ground.
And one of the things I think that really, as a journalist watching the endless conflict of the last decades in the Middle East, that really is exasperating is how easy it has been for the Arab states to just sit back. And they've had a free pass. And I think it's partly there's been an element of, I think David Cameron called it political correctness, a fear of treading on toes that, oh my gosh, we don't want to offend. And I think also a fear of inciting some sort of wrath. But the fact is, that these countries have got to be a big part of the solution, whether or not it's their jets. And some of the and these countries do have militaries supplied quite handsomely, I might say, by the Russians and the Americans,
which the UAE has demonstrated over Libya in the last couple of weeks.
Right, and Qatar was you know heavily involved in Libya.
But just following on that point, and also President Obama's point, which is that the Arab countries have to step up. It's a nice idea in theory, but those same Arab countries, rather surreally, of course, the same Arab countries that have spent the last 10 years blaming the Middle East on America for invading Iraq have spent the last week on blaming Syria on America for not invading Syria.
Well, and I would add to that list, that very good little shopping list you're building, in fact, what we're seeing now is clear evidence that Qatar or Qatar and Kuwait have been instrumental in supplying and building ISIS into the monster it's become. And calling them to account is critical. You know, you have this kind of extremist Sunni ideology that has been funded by these states, and they are now in this position of having to somehow rein in the very monster they've created. The only moderate voice in all of this is, as you've just noted, is really interesting, is UAE, which has had such a low profile globally in regional and global affairs beyond its interest in building the biggest airline in the world and being the finance capital of its region. It's fascinating to see them make statements in the last couple of days about the need to find moderation. It's also interesting to see Kuwait called into account and about its very direct funding of ISIS.
Phil, what have you made of the slight... There's a slight inconsistency of message from America, and I don't know whether it's deliberate or not. I rather suspect it isn't. We've heard John Kerry, the Secretary of State, saying the Islamic State must be destroyed. Vice President Joseph Biden saying that US will follow them to the gates of hell. Whereas Obama, as Obama generally is, has seemed at pains to seem more moderate. Do you think that there's anything he's likely to announce on Wednesday beyond the idea of containment that he appears to have?
Probably not, but I think he's undoubtedly worried about how the US electorate would react if, in fact, there was this stronger message about a military campaign against IS.
It wouldn't be popular, would it?
It would not be popular, and I'm sure that Obama feels some sort of custodianship over his Democrat colleagues are looking to an election not too far into the future. So I'm sure he's kind of releasing his colleagues like Biden and Kerry to kind of run the tough message where he has to be the voice of restraint. So my sense is that that's what's going on at the moment.
Do you think there's a good cop, bad cop thing going on here, Jeffrey?
I think it's Obama's personality. That's just who he is. He is so professorial and so detached from emotion when it comes to these kind of pronouncements. But I think he's also a pragmatist. He recognizes that there are severe limits, and you know what's interesting. I was thinking about this as I was reading about this over the last couple of days. It's so interesting that you see the Arab League now weighing in on this and talking about working with the U.S. It goes back to the point we were talking about a bit earlier. Love it or hate it, you got to do it with the U.S. I mean, that's what the world recognizes, that the kind of technology and firepower needed to destroy ISIS, if it's going to happen, can't be done without the Americans. And I'm actually not persuaded it can be done even with the Americans. Syria and Iraq are failed states. Until you solve that problem, and you know, good luck with that in the next couple of years, I think that they become breeding grounds for this kind of extremism.
Well, on the subject of intractable diplomatic conundrum, last Friday's much-ballyhooed ceasefire in Ukraine appears at best to have been a partial success. Shelling is reported around the port city of Mariupol, and fresh fighting has been reported in and around what remains of the airport in Donetsk. Phil, I'll ask you first, what would Moscow have to gain at this point by persisting? It did seem, at many levels, a pretty comprehensive surrender by Kiev on Friday.
Yeah, it did, but I think it's in Putin's character to want to push this as far as he possibly can. I mean, I think he's very happy with how Friday played out. We saw just how strong Russia was and how weak Ukraine was in those negotiations. Russia basically got everything that it wanted. But on top of that, Putin now sees that the ceasefire buys him some more breathing space, and we're seeing even more Russian troops going across the border into Ukraine in the last couple of days since the ceasefire. So Putin is insatiable. Nothing is enough for this man, and he's going to use even the opportunity of this kind of ceasefire to go even further, I think.
Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko has been in Mariupol, promising a crushing defeat, to use his word, of the rebels. Can he win militarily?
It's an interesting question. Can he win? Not if Putin wants to win. I mean, it's clear that if Putin wants to really crush Ukraine sovereignty in eastern Ukraine, he can do it. So I guess the simple answer is no. But there are other factors at play. I think one of the factors, though, when you talk about the ceasefire being wobbly, is just how much Putin and the Ukrainian government control the extremists. You can agree to a ceasefire, and let's give them the benefit of the doubt. I'm skeptical, but let's say they actually meant it. That doesn't mean that the hotheads on either side are going to actually obey. And so what's not clear is, are these small violations an indication that it's crumbling, or just a bunch of hotheads filing off some missiles they have in their garage?
Well, one of the unpleasant variables of this whole situation, of course, is that either Poroshenko or Putin or both may have actually lost control of the situation. Do you get this? Is what I don't understand. I'll ask you both this question in turn, starting with you, Phil. Whether or not Putin at this point looks to you like somebody who is, as they say in the trade, a rational actor, is what he's doing still making sense from his own point of view?
I mean, I'm not sure he's entirely clear what the strategy is. I mean, I think he's a rational actor, but I think he sees that there are multiple possibilities to kind of advance Russian interests here. I mean, one is the actual sort of extension of the borders and capture of territory. Another one is more just to kind of issue a long-standing threat that puts NATO and the EU and the US on the back foot, which is a situation that Putin can kind of manipulate into the future. So, I think with him, there's also a certain degree of confusion about the current situation. I think he would like to see it play out a little bit more and then make a decisive decision, you know, about what he's going to do. But it seems to me that at the moment, almost all realistic possibilities play into Putin's hands. I think he holds the cards here.
I think when you use the word rational, I think the other word that has to play into this for Russians and for the Russian leadership is emotional. That this is very much payback time for the West for the way they are perceived to have treated the fall of the Soviet Union and the annexation of so many Warsaw Pact countries. I think it's 10 in the years that followed. And the kind of the perceived arrogance of the West in just trampling all of greater Russia, what was the Soviet Union. And I think we grossly miscalculated and grossly misunderstand and underplay just how offended, how wounded, and how enduring that sense of hurt is in Russia for pride and a sense of history. And what Putin has seized on is that. And he, for maybe personal reasons, but also for political reasons in galvanizing his people, he is saying we are going to restore some degree of what was lost. And as you say, you know, damn you, NATO, you're not getting Ukraine.
Well, there is a hugely entertaining subplot to this at the moment, which is the abduction last week of an Estonian security officer.
I don't think it's so entertaining if you're the Estonian security officer.
Indeed not. But abducted near the country's border with Russia last week, removed to Russia. The officer in question, Eston Kova, has been shown on Russian television appearing in court. Moscow says he's a spy. Jeffrey, I'll ask you first. It's always the temptation to always sort of like join one thing up to another is overwhelming in these circumstances. Is it coincidental that a matter of days after Barack Obama turns up in Tallinn saying it's just as precious to NATO as Paris, Berlin, Rome or London?
2 days later. Yeah.
2 days later.
He was
later.
There what, Wednesday. This guy
exactly.
was seized
48
on Friday.
Hours later, yeah. Russians, according to Estonia at least, whose word I'm frankly happy to take, the Moscow's steal across the border, help themselves and an intelligence officer and are basically now saying, and
can we get Graham Greene on the line? I think he could probably answer that question better than any of us. You know, I think when it comes to conspiracy and the FSB, the successor to the KGB,
which was, of course, Vladimir Putin's alma mater.
Right, exactly. You know, I think everything's everything's open to speculation, and nothing is too absurd, but. I think the important point here is that Obama did, on his way to the NATO summit, stop in Estonia and say, "We got your back." And I that was a really interesting political move of his on his part.
Except there is, and I'll put this to you, Phil. There is your back, and there's your back, isn't it? Because what would make sense from Russia's point of view is just seeing exactly what that means, because Russia obviously understands that NATO is not going to invoke Article 5 and start World War III over a kidnapped Estonian security officer. Does Russia then decide, well, how would they feel about a couple of Estonian villages, a medium-sized Estonian town? Is that what we can expect more of, sort of continuing Russian needling and provocation?
Yeah, I think so. I think this is, again, similar to the Ukraine situation. Putin's testing how far he can kind of push everybody on these issues. And, I mean, what was interesting in Obama's comments in Tallinn, in many ways, it's very similar to the situation with IS as well. He's kind of saying, look, NATO has your back, in brackets, the European members of NATO have your back. So no real kind of US dedication to this. So, I mean, there was also sort of some communiques out of Paris and Berlin saying, hang on, what responsibilities would that accrue to us if you're suggesting that this would be our responsibility to start protecting the kind of fringe states around Russia? So I think, you know, out of all of that, Putin looks at a fairly disorganized NATO, a fairly weak Obama, and says, look, I'm going to keep kind of pushing this as far as I can. And as Jeffrey says, it plays out extremely well to a domestic population at home.
But I think that, you know, Putin may be mad and power hungry, but I don't think he's a total fool. And I think that Ukraine is up for grabs because Ukraine is sort of caught between two worlds and remains very much in the post-Soviet orbit of Russia, in Russia's mind, and is not part of NATO. Clearly, the Baltic states are. And I think to answer your hypotheticals, you know, one or two border security guards don't matter. But if they cross in and take a village, that really does force NATO to act in a big way. And I think Putin knows that. Now, I'm quite prepared to sit around this table and say he did it anyway.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Mullett, Jeffrey Kaufman and Phil Clark. When we return, we will be discussing the International Criminal Court and the increasingly troubled trial of Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock, whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Jeffrey Kaufman and Phil Clark. Now, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta appears to be off the hook. His trial at the International Criminal Court has effectively collapsed after prosecutors asked for it to be adjourned indefinitely, saying they didn't have sufficient evidence to proceed. President Kenyatta was charged with crimes against humanity after at least 1,200 people died in sectarian violence following Kenya's elections in 2007. Phil, I'll ask you first. Explain to us, if you will, how this even happens. One would have assumed that you would need to have a case pretty cold before you put a president in the dock.
Yeah, I mean, this tells us a lot, I think, about the dysfunctionality of the ICC. I mean, when the previous prosecutor, Ocampo, put this case together, he actually had to really bend over backwards to convince the judges that he had enough evidence for the case to go ahead. But this is a new court, and I think the judges were quite lenient on the prosecutor at that stage and said, look, we'll give you the benefit of the doubt. Go ahead and see if you can gather a bit more evidence. In the meantime, there's been a change of prosecutor. Fatou Bensouda has come in. She's had another look at the evidence, and I think said, my goodness, that this is not going to stand up to serious scrutiny, so it's better for us to bail out before it gets too ugly. The other thing that Bensouda's worried about is that the Kenyan president has been extremely effective at knocking off Kenyan witnesses left and right. So there have been tens of them that have been killed over the last couple of years. So Bensouda's not only worried about the evidence, but she's also worried about the lack of protection for these witnesses. So she's decided it's better to kind of put the case on hold.
Jeffrey, the ICC in its 10 years of existence has managed to convict so far two fairly obscure Congolese warlords. Mm-hmm. How damaging is this to it?
Well, You know, I think the ICC is still an institution in search of justifying its existence. $1 billion has gone into that place, and man, I don't know about you, but I'm looking for an appointment. Listen, it's a noble cause. These are bad people they're going after, and in principle, this is the right thing for the world to do. But it's not working, maybe these are growing pains. Maybe this is part of it. But its credibility is seriously imperiled by the fact that all of the people it's gone after are Africans. Is that right?
All of, yes. I think I'm right in saying,
they've certainly been under pressure to go after Israel in relation to Gaza, but they understandably and under great pressure have dodged that one. So it seems to be a very regionalized selectivity that's involved. They don't dare go after China. They don't dare go after bigger states. I think with the best of intentions, it just may not be able to do what it was set up to do.
I think that's right. And I think the other thing it's showing is that the court totally relies on cooperation of the domestic states, which is a real difficult thing to do if you're going after members of those states. So I think that what the Kenyan government realized early on was it could block the court's work on the ground at almost every single step. It could jeopardize witnesses. It could deny the court access to areas where it was trying to gather evidence. And if you can do that, you can bring these cases to a halt. Now, that's a massive problem for a court that claims that it's going after the toughest cases around the world. It's almost now inevitably only going to go after the kind of small fry Congolese warlords that you've talked about and not the guys at the top.
I was in Libya when they announced they were going after Gaddafi, and it actually seemed like a bad idea at the time, the timing of it, because that was during the period when the revolution, the civil war, whatever you want to call it, was in this prolonged period of stalemate, and it wasn't at all clear at that point that Gaddafi was going to be found and killed, and so the problem that raised was, how do you try to negotiate some sort of settlement with the bad guy, if the bad guy knows he now has to be sent off to the ICC to face the consequences, which of course is what you want to do, but in the harsh real world, sometimes you have to make uncomfortable deals with bad people to bring peace, and they undermined that in that moment, and the question was, why couldn't they have waited a little longer, or a year longer? They weren't going to get the guy anyway, since he was on the run.
But we'll move finally and briefly, unfortunately, to the United Kingdom, which might be trying to come up with a new name for itself in 10 days' time, if recent polls are to be believed. Some of these suggest that Scotland's independence referendum could be an extremely tight squeeze, though most bookmakers still believe a no vote is odds on. The pound has dipped slightly in response, and stock markets in the UK have today taken a bit of a whacking. Phil, I'll ask you first, leaving aside whether or not it's going to happen, and the odds are still odds on a no vote, how significant one way or the other is this going to be for the United Kingdom? Because the argument's not going to end if the Scots vote no, is it?
No, that's right. I mean, I actually think that there's a sort of a deeper significance here, which is that it's got to a referendum at all. And I think that says something about the kind of hubris and the arrogance of David Cameron and the Tories in Westminster. That, I mean, Cameron could have seen this off at the pass, denied Scotland the chance of a referendum. He even went even further than that and said that, look, 16-year-olds in Scotland could get involved in the vote, and a range of other kind of political concessions. So I'm kind of baffled, in fact, that a UK government would even allow this kind of possibility on the table. It could actually backfire terribly. And in 10 days' time, if Scotland votes yes to go its own way, I'm sure that Cameron's Tory colleagues are going to turn on him quite viciously. He may have to resign. It could be a real political disaster.
Yeah, for me as a Canadian, it's deja vu all over again, having watched two Quebec referendums, one of which was defeated very, very narrowly.
95, wasn't it? Yeah, which was extremely close.
I think 51-49, and barely that. This is. I think that the issues, though, are different. And it's interesting reading the commentary out of Scotland. You can see why there's a sense that the post-Thatcher UK has not been good for a lot of Scots. And there's a sense that, wow, there's prosperity in London and there's a lot of money in the city, the financial district, and lots of big rich people are buying fancy homes. But actually, the average Scot and in fact, people in Northern England have not benefited from post-Thatcher prosperity in the UK. And this is very much a repudiation of that.
It would be a... As you say, the domestic political consequences in the rest of the United Kingdom, it strikes me, have been underrated. It's really only in the last 48 hours that people have started to think, actually, this would be huge.
It's a
for
big
the rest
deal.
Of us.
It's a big deal. Although, you know, I have to reprimand you. I mean, here we are talking about the news of the day, and you haven't even mentioned Kate's pregnancy. What is this program about?
We got so close, 29 and a half minutes in before somebody mentioned.
I mean, another royal baby. Do you realize what this means, American morning shows? I mean, do you realize how many resources will be deployed here to cover this story?
I really, really do.
You're talking this out to the minute. I can see the clock ticking down, aren't you?
I'm basically. This is the literal definition of running out the clock. Jeffrey Kaufman and Phil Clark with the time approaching 18:30. Thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And there's plenty still to come in the second half of today's show. We'll talk to our man in Copenhagen. We'll speak to Lucy Mangan about her new book about Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and review the latest in the visual arts. But before all that, Paul Osborne has the headlines.
The World Health Organization says there's going to be a huge surge in the number of Ebola cases in Liberia, warning that attempts to contain the spread of the disease there are failing. A new map, meanwhile, created by scientists studying the areas most at risk from the spread of Ebola, suggests a large part of Central Africa is now at significant risk. Islamic State militants who were trying to seize the vital Haditha Dam in western Iraq have been repelled by Iraqi government forces. U.S. airstrikes helped to halt the advance of the Islamist fighters. Ukraine's president says pro-Russian rebels in the east of his country have freed 1,200 prisoners. He says the exchange of captives followed the agreement of a ceasefire late last week, a truce which is still largely holding. And a former British Prime Minister will set out plans in the next hour to devolve more powers to Scotland if the country rejects independence in a referendum next week. Gordon Brown will say the proposals amount to a form of home rule, but Scotland's government says it's a last-minute panic after a poll suggested a majority of Scots now favour leaving the UK. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Paul. Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 21:32, near enough, in Moscow. 18:32 in London. That'll be 14:32 in Rio. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we're heading to our man in Copenhagen, Michael Booth. Michael, welcome to the show.
Good evening, Andrew. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. First of all, Denmark have been invited by the United States to join what's being called a core coalition to take on the Islamic State. How is this going over in Denmark? Because Denmark's contribution to the war in Afghanistan was not uncontroversial.
Well, yeah, you would think for a country of only 5 million people, they wouldn't have much to offer. And in truth, they don't have a great deal to offer, this core 8 countries who are coming together to fight against ISIS. That's the UK, France, Germany, Canada, Australia, Turkey, Italy, Poland, America, and Denmark. But it's more a symbolic gesture, really. That over the last 10 years, Denmark has been very quick to join with alliances with the US and the UK in the Middle East. And this is just another instance of that. They were very quick to help with the bombing of Libya, for example, a couple of years ago. And this time they're joining with these 8 core countries. They're offering their 4 F-16 fighters and a big shipping aircraft to Cyprus and so on and so forth. But it's more a symbolic gesture, and I think generally the Danes are quite in favor of this. They understand that they are now inextricably linked with the destiny of the Middle East. And, for example, they have approximately 100 Danish nationals are now fighting with, let's call them the revolutionary forces in Syria and Iraq. So they feel there's a similar kind of type of threat from their nationals returning from these war zones to Denmark, and they want to be part of combating that. Whether or not they make any great impact, that's another kind of discussion, but I think there's a general feeling the Danes are aware there's a danger here and they need to be part of that force to combat it.
Well, moving seamlessly along, a reminder has been discovered that though Denmark may be a relatively placid Scandinavian nation now, that they do have something of a warrior heritage.
Oh, they have, that's how long I've been here, but the Danes have form, of course, in aggression overseas, dating back over 1,000 years to the Viking era, of course, which if you're an Englishman living in Denmark, they don't ever hesitate to remind you about it. And the latest evidence of that has just been discovered. They already have four of these Viking fortresses that have been discovered, but the last one was discovered 60 years ago, and they've just discovered a new one. Right, 30 miles south of Copenhagen. It's the third largest of these Viking forts. And you would wonder, in a country this small, how they didn't notice it before.
Well, that was going to be my next question. I also just want to be able to say on air that these fortresses were built by a Viking warlord magnificently named Forkbeard. But yes, how have they managed to lose one of these things of the last 1,000 years or so?
I honestly don't know the answer. I've been searching for the answer, but I don't know. It's like 475 feet wide. It's very close to the capital city. It was built either by Sven Forkbeard or his father, Harald Bluetooth, who invented, of course,
Bluetooth, even better, yep.
Yeah, it's called Valu Borgring, and they're very excited and proud about it. And so now they have five Viking circle fortresses to offer to the world. How they missed it, I'm not really sure.
How is the Danish media treating this?
Oh, massive. It's front page news. Seriously, front page news and all of the newspapers this week, very excited. You know, the Viking heritage is such an important element of the tourist bid here, the tourist offer in Denmark. So it's a new jewel in the crown, you could say that.
Okay, well, we need to move along finally to the more contemporary world. This is the Danish film director Lars von Trier, who has announced a new television project about which I'm going to start getting annoyed by it now to save myself time later, which is to say I'm really not a fan. But what do we know about what he has planned?
Andrew, I'm so with you. I absolutely detest Lars von Trier, everything he's ever done, everything he stands for. Personally, I don't know if I'm allowed to let my personal opinions come into this little bulletin.
No, I'm perfectly happy for you to do that. Go right ahead.
Yeah, but in customary kind of showman fashion, he announced at the Venice Film Festival this week via live link-up via satellite in a press conference for the director's cut of his last film, which was Nymphomaniac. He announced he's returning to the small screen for the first time in 30 years. He made a TV series, actually quite a highly regarded series, called The Kingdom back in the 90s, set in a derelict kind of rundown hospital in Copenhagen. He's coming back with a new TV series, and what's interesting about it is he's doing it with DR, which is the national broadcaster in Denmark, who's become world famous for these amazing drama series such as The Killing and Borgen and The Bridge. And he's doing it with a good friend of Monocle's, Peel Berndt, who's the producer and who's produced those series. And it's going to be called The House That Jack Built. It's going to be in English. We're going to be able to see it in 2016. And it's going to have an international, huge international cast, they promise. And it's going to be on something we've never seen before.
So it's not going to be people in cardigans solving murders?
Who knows? The House That Jack Built, I do know it was the track from a Metallica album from a few years ago. The drummer in Metallica is Danish. Maybe we can piece together the clues there.
Lars von Trier and Metallica together at last. Michael, thank you. That was Michael Booth, Monocle's man in Copenhagen. Up next on this episode of Midori House, we'll be talking to Lucy Mangan about her new book about Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Global affairs, culture, business, design, or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas, or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London, W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Wynn Content and is edited by Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 has over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock. If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, coming up for 1840 in London. Now, Roald Dahl's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is 50 years old this year and is, by any measure, one of the most influential children's books ever written. It was Dahl's second full-length post-war children's novel after James and the Giant Peach and confirmed his unlikely career move from ace fighter pilot and intelligence officer to best-selling children's author. It has been made into two films, one of them a classic, the other not quite, and has now inspired a book about the book, Inside Charlie's Chocolate Factory by Lucy Mangan, who joins me now. Lucy, there probably isn't a child in the entire post-war Western world who hasn't read this book at some point. What was your first experience of it?
I don't actually remember the first time I read it. I just remember always having read it. So it must have been pretty early. I reckon I must have been about six. All I remember is this: it's starting to fall apart in my hand. So I know I did read it a lot.
See, I was trying to think exactly the same thing. When did I first read it? And I can't.
It's
in the atmosphere now. Why do you think it has endured? It's hard enough to write a book that anybody reads at all, never mind a book that people read in 6 months' time, but a book that people read half a century later, and there's no reason to imagine they won't be reading it another 50 to 100 years. What is it about this one?
I think it's that when you look at it, it's actually a very, you know, for all Dahl's reputation as a maverick and a subversive and a, you know, wildly inventive guy, he really was that. But in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, it's bolted on to really quite an old-fashioned fable, sort of fairy tale-ish structure and, you know, ending, and the whole thing actually works in a very elemental kind of way. And just like you wouldn't say, oh, Grimm's fairy tales are too old, or they're going to go out of fashion, they'll never endure. You can't really say that about a modern fairy tale either.
So the book Inside Charlie's Chocolate Factory, it is a book about the book and about everything else the book has spawned. On the latter especially, in trying to track down the book's resonance and its influence, how were you able to quantify that? Because that is a real how long is a piece of string question.
It is, but it's quite nice because you've got Mel Stewart's autobiography, who's the guy that directed the 1971 film, and he charts, in the final part of that, he charts this really rather lovely realisation that his film was getting a second life, because it more or less bombed at the box office when it opened. But then it got this second life when it started being shown on television in the US, and then it's, you know, then this thing called video came in and people started buying it for their children to be able to watch at any time, and suddenly it took off. And of course now we've got the internet, which has given it a whole other life, or moments of it at least, because Gene Wilder's face lends itself so well to memes and GIFs and all the rest of it. And again, it's that fairy tale element, you know, they can be updated and they can be plugged into any generation. And it keeps itself going after a while.
Were there any things you found in your research that really surprised you? Because, again, it's that whole pulling a very long piece of string stuff, and he was such an unusual man with such a strange life and strange career. Was there anything that leapt out at you in the research?
I didn't realise that he hated cream eggs. That took a moment to get over. And I also hadn't quite appreciated, and I don't go into great detail with it in the book, but I hadn't quite appreciated that he was basically a spy in the war. Yeah, I think that's And it was the first thing my husband said to me when I got the job. And I was like, oh, really? Was he? And I said, it's much more of a boys thing. I think I'd glossed over that.
Fighter pilot as well.
And yeah, fighter ace, absolutely.
Which is it Going Solo or Flying Solo? His book about being a fighter ace is amazing.
Going Solo.
Going Solo, that's the one. It's clearly a long time since I read that as well. But back to Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Do you think it's one of those things that... Do you read it differently as an adult? Do you see things differently as an adult? Is it one of those things, say, like The Simpsons, which works at any number of levels to a number of different age groups?
It is, and he part of the reason he sort of turned to writing children's books was because he was so fed up of reading ordinary, quotes, children's books to his kids. And now when you read it again, you can see just how funny and how really odd, in a very adult way, Willy Wonka is. All these, it's a very adult thing to do a son of asides in a children's book is a really strange phenomenon. You don't see it very much, but Wonka, of course, is always saying, oh, well, maybe he will, maybe he won't, I don't know, and he's kind of murmuring away to himself. And that's, you know, you don't appreciate that as a child. You're more about the meadow made of sweets, for example.
But there's also that thing, isn't there, about, and again, sort of thinking of modern resonances, I was reminded, the first few times I saw South Park, and I couldn't quite figure out what it reminded me of, and eventually I figured out it reminded me of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, because leaving aside the saintly Charlie, it does address the truth about children, which is that they're terrible. They're
Absolutely.
Just these horrible, self-involved, atavistic, greedy little bastards.
Yeah, they're vile. and that's this great kind of secret that Dahl lets you in on, is that actually everyone knows children are vile, and these ideals adults keep holding up of manners and everything are just that, ideals. They don't actually expect you to be able to attain them. It's just...
Do you think there's any kind of moral to the book?
It's quite a strongly moral thing once you look at, you know, Charlie does get rewarded. Everyone, you know, for the sin of being fat, you know, Augustus Gloop suffers, being spoiled, you get suffered. Mere gum chewing, you know, gets you clobbered.
That struck me as harsh, frankly,
slightly harsh.
Even at the time.
And of course, watching television instead of reading books. It's in, you know, it's a very old-fashioned message under a, you know, explosive mass of very modern invention.
Sophie Dahl, Roald Dahl's granddaughter, writes the foreword for the book. What are her memories of him? Does she recall him as a fake? Because he put that way with, and it, clearly Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is a way of him working through some of his objections to the modern world. He does come across as a slightly rigorous and severe figure.
Well, he was a man of, you know, of a certain class and type and age. And of course, when he was writing Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the 60s were beginning and everything was turning to shit, you know. I think that's more what it was all about rather than children, because he did always adore children. He was very, you know, devoted to his own and then to his grandchildren, and grew up in a very happy family and adored his sisters as well.
And just finally, Gene Wilder or Johnny Depp?
Oh, Gene Wilder.
The absolutely correct answer. Lucy Mangan, thank you very much for joining us. Lucy Mangan's book, Inside Charlie's Chocolate Factory, is out on Penguin Now or Now About. So you're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. We are going to play a spot of music now. We'd like to play music which is related to the item that we just did. I did want to play something by Veruca Salt. You see what we would have done there, but I was overruled. But this is Chocolate by the 1975. That was the 1975 with Chocolate. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Nearly 1851 in London. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And at around this time on the programme, we like to review what is coming up, what is the best, occasionally the worst in the worlds of the arts. Today we are talking the visual arts in general with Francesca Gavin. Francesca, welcome back to the programme.
Hello, lovely to see you again.
We're going to start in Amsterdam.
An incredible show, a show that's worth travelling for, I think, which is the biggest retrospective of Marlene Dumas, who's a South African painter, but who's been based in Amsterdam. For much of her career. She moved originally in the 70s to Harlem. And this has got up to 200 paintings and drawings, including things directly from her studio, things that have never been seen, as well as a complete backlog. It should be incredible.
Is that the biggest collection of her works ever assembled?
Definitely. It's the biggest retrospective in Europe that she's ever had. But yeah, it's going to be definitely the largest selection of her work.
Why has it taken this long to put something of this scale together? You know, as you say, she's a significant personage at this point.
I think it's something to do with the trends within contemporary art itself that we're increasingly seeing, mid-career, towards later career, women getting a little bit more attention in the contemporary art world as major names. So as much as everyone's always respected Marlene Dumas' work, now you're seeing artists like Phyllida Barlow, etc., Louise Bourgeois when she was alive, sort of being reaching status in a much stronger way than I think they would have necessarily 15 years ago.
The exhibition is at the Stedelijk in Amsterdam. The title of the exhibition, which has started, in fact, 2 days ago, is running till January, so that's plenty of time, is The Image as Burden. Where is she going with that title?
Well, I think it's the most interesting way of looking at that in relationship to her most recent work. She had an incredible show recently, which was in London at Frith Street about 2 years ago, a year and a half, and it was filled with images of, you know, the crucifixion alongside people that had been attacked by the media. So Bin Laden, Amy Winehouse, and the Bin Laden painting was one of the most incredible paintings I've ever seen in my life.
But there were good reasons for Bin Laden getting a bad press, in fairness.
No, completely. Well, I think in all the things that are, but it was a really interesting contrast in the idea, this idea of burdening. I think she's also looking at the relationship between the role of the image, the idea of painting, and all those kind of internal conversations that run around what painting is at this moment in time.
So worth travelling to Amsterdam to see. I mean, Amsterdam's worth travelling to Amsterdam to see.
But and the Stedelijk, the new building, is incredible. I travelled out there personally just to go to the Mike Kelly last year, and it was worth it. The new building is wild.
We have talked about the new building intermittently on Monocle 24. What is it like to visit as a visitor?
It's wonderful. It's very modern, but it's very spacious, and you really feel like you can see the work. I think it functions very well wandering around it. It really works well as a gallery.
Well, we'll return to London for the next exhibition you wanted to talk about. This is at the 17 Gallery, I think I'm right in saying. Sashan Kaylee's tactile paintings, which kind of look at you almost as if they're urging you to reach out and give them a scratch, though I suspect that would be frowned upon.
Well, it's sort of the contrast view of what painting is. And I think this artist who recently graduated from the Royal Academy and is opening 17's new space in Haggerston, they've moved further up into East London, is a great emerging space. I think he typifies a kind of approach to abstraction that's really fascinating at the moment, where it's very much process-led. It is very tactile. It's actually not paint. It's made out of casts of plaster that are recast and then stretched and then recast and stretched. So you have an exhibition filled with work that starts with one small thing that's been spray-painted. It looks a bit like an alien landscape or a moonscape, and then grows throughout the space. And I think it's really fascinating. And it's interesting that he, as an artist, already has a solo show emerging at the CFA in Berlin. So we're living in an interesting moment for painting, I think.
As you say, only graduated from the RCA last year. This is a somewhat sudden rise, isn't it?
Well, at the Royal Academy last year, he did his BA at the RCA. I think it's a real indication of the way the art market is functioning, particularly in its relationship to abstraction, where you're seeing a lot of young painters, particularly working with, you know, abstract painting in some form, suddenly getting a lot more attention and movement than they would have necessarily. There's a huge amount of investment in that kind of work, particularly coming out of LA and New York, but also you're seeing it in artists here.
And so Sashan Kaylee at the 17 in Haggerston, worth travelling all the way to East London to see.
Yeah, but they're wonderful. They're like weird yellow moons.
Like weird yellow moons in East London. Yeah. Okay. Finally, to Tricia Middleton's Making Friends With Yourself exhibition. What did you make of this one?
Well, again, I thought this was an interesting redefinition of the directions of what painting could be. And then this time, it's an installation. Jessica Bradley is, in my opinion, the best contemporary art space in Toronto, which itself has a rising scene. And her work feels a bit like, it's filled with like pastel colors and dripping wax, and it's a bit like you're stepping into a crazy mind studio, strange space, and it's got this kind of sense of freedom and explosion. Something that, in terms of palette, could relate to people like Katharina Gross in Germany or Carla Black in Scotland. This kind of redefinition of how you create installation that has a very painterly feel.
This is the Tricia Middleton exhibition we're talking about at the Jessica Bradley Gallery in Toronto. It starts on the 11th of September till the 8th of November. Again, I could ask the same question, worth travelling all the way to Toronto to see?
I believe in travelling for art. I think I'm a big fan of pilgrimage, and I think international travel is part of the entire joy of that whole process.
How much is it, I guess, what is the importance of, because anybody can look at pictures of the Tricia Middleton pieces, and they do look like, I'm put in mind irresistibly of my own abortive attempts to make candles in art class at school, but to what extent is the scale and the presence of them important?
Well, I think with all these artists, seeing work in the flesh is a huge difference. I mean, a lot of her stuff is very installation-led. I think this might be a bit more object-led based on a residency she's just done in New York. But what you feel, even with looking at the Sacha and Kaylee, even when looking at the Marlene Dumas, the experience of seeing the work in person is so different from a reproduction. It always blows me away. You think that it's a cliche, the idea that reproduction flattens something, even in our days of digital experience. But actually being in the space is a huge difference.
Okay, and just finally, I guess, those three exhibitions are all currently showing or about to be currently showing in Amsterdam, London and Toronto. Are there any things you're looking forward to coming up in the next few weeks?
Well, I'm personally going to Istanbul for the first time, and there's a contemporary art fair there at the end of September, and it's becoming a really interesting space, I think, for contemporary art. You're seeing a huge rise of galleries. I'm personally working on the collection for the Soho House, which is opening there in spring. So that's my personal excitement. And of course, it's back to school for the art world. It's September at Freeze and Fiac in October. There's a huge sort of energy that comes with autumn.
Istanbul, I can confirm, is always a treat. Istanbul for the first time is a massive, massive treat. You'll enjoy that. Francesca Gavin, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And that is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks in particular to our earlier special guests, Jeffrey Kaufman and Phil Clark. Today's show was produced by Alice Block, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Rebecca Unger. Our studio manager was Joel Church. Up next after the headlines, Culture with Rob Bound, 2200 The Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson and Chloe Potter. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London time. But for this edition of the show, it's goodbye. Thanks very much for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.